Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by this message from M. Night Shyamalan. I know I used to be good and now I suck. It was a conscious choice. That's the twist ending. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I am Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
And today we're talking about, I think, something we wanted to get to once we decided to do a film podcast.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is one of the first topics we threw out there.
Yeah, now that we've mentioned Christopher Nolan for every podcast, let's...
We actually didn't mention him once in the Michael Jordan podcast.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's believable, but still surprising we didn't manage to fit that in there.
Yeah.
So yeah, this one is all about one of... I don't know, one of our favorite movies, I guess? One that we both seem to agree on and like a lot?
Certainly my favorite trilogy of movies.
Yeah?
Yeah, 1 to 3, definitely.
Yeah, see, I saw a good article arguing just that point, but it's the Bourne trilogy is what we're discussing here.
Yeah.
The Bourne Identity, the Bourne Supremacy, and the Bourne Ultimatum. You know, I guess we touched on it a little bit in the adaptation ones, but this is one coming from a series of novels, right?
Yes.
But
the first half of the Bourne Identity, I can speak from experience, is exceptionally boring.
Yeah. But they're successful books, right?
I honestly don't know. I would imagine.
Yeah, I guess they got big enough to spawn a whole film franchise.
Yeah.
But it's changed a lot from the source material by the time we get to the films. When was the first one made?
2002.
Yeah, I think it came out in June 2002 after a little bit of a... It wasn't the most easily made film. I think they had some problems between the studio and the filmmakers about exactly how they wanted to do everything.
Yeah, they went back and reshot the ending of the first movie, the action sequence, I think, towards the end in the staircase. I think that was added in reshoots because the studio wasn't happy with the lack of action at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and again, I mean, they would be... All the Bourne movies you think would be categorized as action, maybe thriller or spy or espionage, if you want to get into those sort of subcategories of it.
Yeah.
But it's still not... I mean, it's action-packed, but it's still a bit more cerebral than most action movies, right?
The first one is certainly more of that. Second one is almost just a straight action movie the whole way through. Third one, there's certainly things in it, in the third one, outside of the action, but it's a very fast-paced movie. You typically get all of the meaning in Bourne Ultimatum just in like the 3 minutes between action scenes.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable that it's such a good movie with the amount of action that it is and that they still get so many interesting things out there. But
yeah, because it's not just interesting as an action movie, but as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess we should give sort of just an overview of the entire trilogy probably, right?
Because
we're going to touch on all three of these movies throughout this.
Yeah.
So what's where do we pick up in the very first one?
The first thing we see in the Bourne Identity is Jason Bourne, who we don't know is Jason Bourne yet, but just floating in the water in the middle of a thunderstorm, and it looks like he's unconscious, and a fishing boat basically picks him up, and he wakes up and has no memory of who he is, has no idea where he is, has no idea how he got there, and yeah, he's just... has absolutely no memory of anything, really.
Right.
Well, he remembers how to do really complicated things, like how to tie knots and all these, and how to speak and all that stuff.
Yeah.
He has no idea who he is, essentially.
And we've seen the spy thing with amnesia before. That's not new.
I'm sure we have. I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think when they were doing more spy movies and more thrillers and espionage and things like that, that was sort of a common thing to... Well, not common, but this certainly he wasn't the... Robert Ludlum didn't come up with the idea of a spy having amnesia. It's been done before, but I think this was one of the really big ones.
Yeah.
And the novels really put that on the forefront. And I think it is a great movie for... A great idea for a movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, it basically when... You start off with a character who knows nothing about themselves. You're basically putting the audience right in that character's shoes because the audience doesn't know anything about him.
Yeah.
So especially like the first one in the series, right?
Yeah.
So,
and I guess just along the same ground of, you know, kind of being put into the shoes of the character, in this case, Jason Bourne, they do that a lot with the visuals as well, right?
Yeah. Less in the first movie, but it's still, you can certainly see the seeds of the style that would come in the second and third movie, but the action sequences especially, there's a lot of handheld camera.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm a fan of the style.
Yeah. I want to get, definitely want to get back to that because that is something that you always hear talked about when these movies are discussed, whether it's
Because it's very important.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And it, I think it certainly makes or breaks a lot of people's opinions on it. People who don't like these movies usually point to the cinematography as being one of the big things that they really didn't like in it. Mm-hmm. But for now, I think I just want to kind of get the whole overview of the trilogy out of the way. So he wakes up, you know, realizes he doesn't know
who he is
or what he's doing. He starts putting his life together. And then he meets up with Marie.
Yep. Played by Franca Potente,
yes.
Also known as Lola.
Yes, of Run Lola Run. And they find they kind of just have a way to help each other, right?
Yeah, yeah. She needs... Well, I don't think she needs anything from him. He just offers her money. And
well, she needs money, though.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Her main concern at the beginning seems to be a visa, and I don't know that the money would have helped her, kind of.
Yeah, I think the visa was a big part of it. I also just think she doesn't have a lot of money.
If someone gives you $20,000 to drive to France, you do it.
Yeah, you know? No matter how broke you are, I guess. And so, as you said, you know, they have to try to get to France. It's kind of the last lead he has on figuring out his identity. He was in Paris recently, so he goes back there to try to retrace his steps and kind of make sense of it and try to figure out who he is. And he finds an address that he was told he used to live at, and he shows up, and everyone seems to recognize him, and, you know, they don't act like anything's really wrong. He just says he's lost his key, trying to just kind of play along, and he's a fast-thinking guy, right?
Yeah, he's real quick.
Yeah, he's quick on his feet, yeah. And we kind of learn some of the other skills he has in that scene in the diner, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of the first time he's realizing that not only does he not know who he is, but that person who he's forgetting must have been a very exceptional person.
Yeah. He mentions how basically he knows he walks in and he's immediately looking for all the exits in the diner. He knows that the most likely place to find a handgun is in like the glove box, 18-wheeler or something out in the parking lot. And he knows that the guy sitting at the bar knows how to handle himself.
Yeah, exactly. So right when he kind of enters a room, even though he doesn't really know who he is or why he's doing it, he's picking up on all these things like where the best exits are, and if things go wrong and violent, you know, what are the best ways to get out of it and things like that. So he's still not quite sure who he is, but he knows he's not your average person.
No. Yeah, exactly.
And he finds that thing in his hip.
Yeah, well, that's very early on. It's sort of like the laser pointer thing that's got, like, a bank account number on it, essentially.
And so then he tracks that down that bank account, finds he's got a whole bunch of passports, guns.
This is before the diner, though. This is before he meets Marie.
Yeah, and so he's got passports, guns, money, just kind of shady things. If you were to find it on someone else, you'd be a little freaked out. And then to find it on yourself is a whole other thing.
Well, right? He doesn't take the gun at the beginning.
That's true.
I think it's kind of telling that he's sort of afraid of who he is.
Yeah, exactly. So as you said before, you know, we're kind of in the same spot as him. We're kind of piecing it together just as he's piecing it together,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so what happens for the rest of the first film after he gets to Paris?
Oh, basically he starts to figure out that he was essentially an assassin, and he was supposed to kill Wambosi, a government official who I don't think was in government anymore.
Yeah, I think he was in exile.
Yeah. His mission was essentially to kill Wambosi, and he failed, and Wambosi shot him in the back, and that's where the amnesia came in. And yeah, he ends up fighting a couple other assassins who were in the same project as he was. And then, what was Conklin, played by Chris Cooper? He has a run-in with him where Conklin sort of tells him a little bit of details about his life. And then Bourne has to get out of that situation. It gets a little violent. Yeah, that's essentially the end of the movie. He ends up with Marie in a scooter shop she opened in what looks like Greece.
It is Greece, yeah. Yeah, so he basically finds out he was part of the CIA. He was in this program. He really is piecing it together and doesn't know that much about it. But he was effectively working as an assassin for the CIA, and they sent him to kill Wambosi, as you said, who is, you know, the former leader of the country. And not the greatest thing to find out about yourself.
No. You could learn better things, for sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, throughout this whole movie, he's very focused on what he's doing, but still very clueless about who he is and what all these things are leading up to.
And I'm a really big fan of Matt Damon in this movie. Like, I think he's, as far as acting goes, like, in the second and third ones, he has significantly less to do as far as dialogue goes.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoy how he played, like, the confusion and all of that. Because, like, he plays most of his characters the same sort of style. Like, he's a good actor, at a two different things, basically. He can play a goofball well, like we see in the Informant and the Ocean's movies.
Yep.
And he can also play a serious guy pretty well. But there's something about his performance that, like, this is my favorite Matt Damon performance that isn't the Informant. And I don't know, it just really, you really feel for the character. And I first saw this movie before I cared about Matt Damon at all.
Yeah.
And yeah, and this was kind of what sold me on him as an actor. I was like, okay, this is good.
Well, did you see some of the other people who were considered for...
Wasn't Ben Affleck? Didn't Ben Affleck suggest Matt Damon or try and talk Matt Damon into doing it?
I didn't hear that one.
Okay. I feel like there's some sort of rumor where either Ben Affleck suggested Matt Damon or Ben Affleck talked Matt Damon into doing it.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I saw they had Russell Crowe under consideration, who I think would be good.
I would have been just fine with that.
Yeah. I think it would have been a slightly different character, but I think it would have been good enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, in The Insider, you kind of see the weak, sort of timid side of Russell Crowe, but still something just below the surface where if he needs to bring it out,
yeah, well,
he can snap.
There's a lot of rage in his character in The Insider.
Yeah, exactly. And I think with Jason Bourne, there is this character where there's kind of this veneer he needs to put on to try to function, even though he doesn't know who he is, just try to this sort of normal guy exterior just to try to navigate through the world and kind of pick up some clues. But just below that, when things go wrong, he can, you know, do all those things that he got through CIA training and just really take a 180-degree turn and just snap like that.
Yeah.
And the other person I saw was being considered was Sylvester Stallone.
Wow.
Which made...
Wow, in 2002 he was being considered? Yeah. Or was this something that was being done for a while?
No, I think it was just right in 2001, 2002.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would not have worked.
I don't think so.
Because, like, there's just too much baggage with seeing Stallone in something, you know? Like, you can't sort of take him at face, like, just take him as a character anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
And, I mean, Matt Damon's famous, but at that point he wasn't as famous.
He was Good Will Hunting famous.
Yeah. You know? But
he
not
wasn't
a
born
huge,
famous yet.
And not a huge action star famous.
Yeah, certainly not.
So the second one, Bourne Supremacy, kind of pick up where we left off.
Yeah, well, a couple years later, they're now in Goa, I think.
India.
Yeah. Yeah. And a couple things have switched as far as the crew goes. Like, Doug Liman directed the first one. He did not direct the second and third.
Right. Yeah, I guess we should talk about who's responsible for the first one.
Yeah. So. Directed by Doug Liman, who directed, up to that point, he directed Swingers, Go, and then I think Bourne Identity was his next movie.
Okay.
And since The Bourne Identity, he has directed only bad movies with Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Jumper and Fair Game, I think, was the one he did last year that I didn't see.
Yikes.
But yeah, no, and that's why I can't find why he didn't direct the sequel. I would imagine he had an opportunity to.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, since he did produce the second and third one, he hasn't directed anything good since. So it's really interesting to me that...
Yeah, so then who changed up for the second one?
Well, they brought in Paul Greengrass.
Right.
Director, and... Which is really interesting because the highest profile movie he had done to that point was Bloody Sunday, which is a very little seen movie, not something that you would expect someone to be like, oh yeah, let's get this guy to direct our blockbuster movie.
Yeah, because the first Bourne was really successful, right? Like it made a lot of money and it was very popular and
made enough money to get a sequel.
Yeah, well, yeah, not tons of money. It wasn't a huge blockbuster, but had a pretty decent budget and certainly made it back a few times over and. Largely positive reviews from critics and fans.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's enough to warrant a sequel, especially when you have a sequel essentially already written in a series of books. You know what I mean? Like, you already have so much to draw from.
Yeah, well, they really stray really far away from the books, from everything I've read.
Yeah.
Quickly, they stray far away from the books. It's essentially the central idea of the character. And
of just the amnesia, pretty much, is open that stays.
And the spy stuff, and... like I said, I haven't read much more than the first half of the first book, so I mean, I can't really speak from experience, but I remember reading something like Tony Gilroy saying he used the books as like a very, very loose sort of thing to work with.
Yeah, no, he's admitted that. He's also said that he tried to kind of reshape a couple things to fit more of his political views, which I think we can get to later, he certainly... didn't go word for word from the book, that's for sure. And changed a lot of it. And so in the second one, Bourne has more of a clue of who he is and what he's doing, but he still wants to figure out how he got there. And mostly it's an issue of revenge at this point. It turns into a sort of trying to figure out who did this to him.
Well, I don't think he's not trying very hard at the beginning. It's only once they kill Marie. The beginning of the Bourne Supremacy, we see basically someone trying to frame Bourne so that the CIA will start coming after him again. And then the same assassin who frames Bourne in this operation in Zurich, I think it is.
Yeah.
Then goes to Goa to kill Bourne, accidentally kills Marie instead, thinking it is Bourne that he's killing. And then basically that sets Bourne on a rampage, essentially, for yeah. the rest of the movie. And he goes to get his revenge and also to find out why the CIA still wants anything from him.
Yeah. Between one and two, we get the idea he's gone from Greece to Italy, probably just traveling the world for a couple of years, trying to lay low and just trying to be ahead of the people hunting him down because he knows they're after him. He's taking notes of everything he can think of and trying to piece back the little bits of memory he has to try to make more of a history for himself and understand who he is and how he got here.
He's still having nightmare flashbacks, but he can't totally piece them together, and that's why he's sort of writing these things down.
Yeah, but you're right. For a while, he's just been... Between one and two, we basically just see him running away.
Yeah.
And then number two, when Marie dies...
He runs after
them. Yeah, he turns around. It's them. It's him hunting them now. It's a lot more of an active pursuit.
Yeah. And, I mean, we can sum up the second one really quickly. He ends up killing the assassin and getting away from the CIA, and we're...
Spoiler.
There's going to be a spoiler on the website, so... Yeah, and then the third one is similar. It just sort of picks up where the second one left off, essentially. Well, a couple minutes before the end of the second one is where it picks up, but...
Yeah, you bring up a good point of the timeline of all three of them. There's a little bit of a break in the continuity. It's not just completely linear all the way through, right?
From the end of the first movie to the beginning of the second one, I would guess there's something like 2 years or something.
Yeah.
And, from the end of the second movie, like the last scene in the second movie ends up being a scene in the middle of the third movie.
Yeah.
So the Bourne ultimatum essentially starts after he talks to the Russian Nesky girl.
Yeah.
And then he walks away from her apartment. That's where the third one starts, essentially.
And the Nesky girl, I mean, this is something that kind of makes him different than a lot of other spies and a lot of other character protagonists in action movies, and especially a lot of CIA hitmen, is that at the end of the first... one, he kind of wants to sort of make up and atone for what he's done, and he goes after one of his victim's daughters to try to explain to her.
Yeah, at the end of the second one.
Yeah, I mean. At the end of the second one, yeah.
The nightmare flashbacks he's having in Supremacy are essentially him remembering that he killed a Russian official and his wife, and the official's wife, and framed it like the wife killed the Russian man, and then she killed herself. So this daughter essentially grew up thinking that her parents died in a murder-suicide, but it really was Bourne killing them both.
Right.
Just making it look like that. So he wanted to go apologize for her, to her. And it's essentially like Marie makes him think of this, because, say, had Marie died without him knowing, he would have wanted to know how she died.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the pairing that they use for that. And so he confesses to the Nesky girl, the Russians are named Nesky, and their daughter.
Yeah.
So we're calling the Nesky girl because I don't remember her name.
Yeah.
And and then he confesses to her, and then he sort of walks away, and that's essentially where the third one picks up.
Right. So for the first one, two, he's kind of just figuring out who he is. The entire time, the CIA is still just throwing assassins at him.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where a lot of the action comes from, is him just trying to defend himself from essentially other versions of him, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we learn in the third one, is that he entered some program where... they basically took his identity, right?
Yeah.
And gave him a new one?
Yeah, they gave him the Bourne identity. They made him Jason Bourne.
That's right. So he finds out that his real name is David Webb, and that after all this chasing in the third, after, you know, the first three movies, he does get to his boss, or his former boss, or the person he feels made him the way he is, right?
Yeah. Well, I think, it's not really in debate at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear. I don't remember. What's his name?
Ward Abbott, I think.
Okay. And yeah, the third movie is basically going back to where he comes from. He just wants to know more about himself, because what does he have to do other than that? He wants this to end. He wants to make it end in the most final way he can. And he doesn't really care about himself anymore. Like, he doesn't have Marie, so he doesn't have anything to worry about. He can just sort of, you know, try and figure this all out. And if he fails, he fails. And
so all of this training that the CIA training and a lot of this new identity taking that we were discussing, this all happened in a building in New York. So at the end of the third one, the big climax is that he gets back into New York, and that's where all the chase scenes happen and the really cool car chase in the third one.
Yep. And it's all just to get back to this building so he can basically meet his maker. And then the end of the movie and And this leads to the cool thing about this trilogy, or one of my favorite things about this trilogy, is that, and you didn't see the movies when they were first coming out, whereas I did. And in the second movie, when Marie dies in like the first 5-10 minutes, I was just like, whoa, okay, anything can happen, right?
Yeah.
And I loved the second one. I liked it significantly more than I liked the first one. Still do, for various reasons. And then the third one, I was sort of like, I knew it was going to be the end of the trilogy going into it. And I was pretty sure anything could happen. Like, I wasn't sure Dick Bourne was going to live to the end.
Yeah.
And so there's that last, the very end of the movie is Bourne basically jumping off this building in New York while someone shoots at him. And it's not, you don't see whether or not a bullet hits him. You don't see him move. Like, he lands in the water, and it's basically a recreation of the first shot of the first movie.
No, he's just kind of laying still in the water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's sort of news reports playing with Julia Stiles' character wherever she ends up, and she's watching the news, basically hearing about these reports of David Webb going off the building.
Yeah.
And he's lying motionless, and then the last thing you hear from the news report is, search has been going on for a couple of days, but still no body has been found.
Yeah.
And then you see Jason Bourne swim away, and it's the end of the trilogy. And I've never been, like, more physically shaken by suspense in a movie in my life. Like, I was totally trembling the first time I saw it. Like,
whether or not he was going
to
move.
Yeah, and I wanted him to survive so badly. But it was the only time in at least a series of movies where I was watching totally unsure, like, absolutely 50-50 he could have died.
Yeah. Like, it's been like a dark and realistic trilogy up until this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, as realistic as some of the things he does can be.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, had he died, I wouldn't have been surprised. And that he lived, I wasn't surprised. In retrospect, it does make more sense for him to live. But at the time, man, it was intense. I could barely take it. It was like that and Mean Creek are the only movies that ever made me like physically like shake in a movie theater. And I don't know, this is intense.
Yeah, well, we talked about, I mean, we just touched on the realism there, and you're right, I mean, it's still pretty ridiculous. It's still an action movie. I mean, you're still going to have crazy things happen. And
that car chase in the end of the second movie in Russia is my favorite car chase in any movie. That car could not take that beating, you know? Like,
that's for sure.
So,
and even, I mean, some things, like the guy who choreographed, not choreographed, I guess, but put together the chase in Paris in the second one.
You mean first one?
Yeah, the first one, sorry.
Yeah, first one's the chase in Paris.
Yeah, he was saying that, and everyone, he got tons of respect for that. That's a great car chase.
It's pretty cool.
A lot of people recognized it as such. He said, yeah, it is, and it looks really good, but people who know Paris at all know it's so silly. Like, these areas don't connect at all, and it's not CGI or anything like that. These are all real places, but he turns a corner on one side of Paris, and he's in the other side of Paris.
Well, maybe that's where the splashy tires come in.
Yeah, I guess so. But, yeah, I mean, it is fairly realistic. I mean, I guess I'm just comparing it to Bond, so
yeah,
it's more realistic than that. But, I mean, he does things that you don't see your main action stars do. Like, he eats, you know what I mean? That's something that you just don't see action characters really do. They kind of have this invincible thing to them where you never see them take washroom breaks or eat or do all the, like, the basic human functions.
Yep. Yeah, no, you do get that.
You do. And it seems, I mean, I can't really say 100%, but it looks like he's actually eating, not just Jason Bourne, but Matt Damon actually appears to be chewing something and swallowing it. And that doesn't happen in movies very much. You kind of get, they cut away, like, right before they put the food in their mouth. And then
Brad Pitt in the Ocean's movies is, or at least the first one, is constantly eating, like, whenever he gets a chance. And I remember reading Brad Pitt being like, you know, I always see these movies where people are never eating, and I'm like, when do they get the time to eat? And his thinking was, yeah, I just got to eat on the run. So, at one point in the movie, he's just eating a bowl of shrimp, you know, just, like, really standing, having a conversation at a casino with George Clooney. It was
That's
really
awesome.
Funny. Yeah.
Way to go, Brad.
Yeah, so that was his thing for the first Ocean's movie, at least.
Yeah, and Jason Bourne bleeds, too.
Yes,
I mean,
he
gets cut and injured and things like that.
Yep.
And you don't see that with a lot of people, either.
No, well, I mean, there's sort of the 80s action star was basically invulnerable. Like, you would always get that one cut just above the eyebrow, you know?
Yeah.
And your face would get a little dirty and there might be a bruise, but it never really felt like they were in any danger. Whereas Bourne is basically going up against his equals, and in some cases, people being trained with a higher version of the program than him.
Yeah, because he left at one point, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they stayed in and kept training.
Exactly. So, I mean, Professor in the first one probably knows more than Bourne at that point. And the second second movie, the guy fights with a rolled up magazine in his house. Like, that guy was in the program longer than Bourne, just because, you know, Bourne got shot. And the third one, I think, is whoever was Edgar Ramirez. Is that the actor's name? I don't remember the.
I don't know.
Oh, and Desh the assassin, which is the best hand to hand fight, period. And Desh has got higher level training than.
Yeah, I mean, as you're saying, the guy he fights in with the rolled up newspaper in his house, that guy's hands are essentially handcuffed.
Yeah, exactly. And he still almost kills him.
Yeah, he still almost gets the edge on Bourne, right?
Yeah.
So who's your favorite assassin?
I don't know. I don't like Bourne, I guess.
Without counting Bourne.
I guess Desh. I don't know, just because Desh led to the coolest fight.
Desh's fight, I think, is the best.
The Desh fight, the one we're talking about, is the one in Tangier, where there's this big... Bourne is running across all of these rooftops, and he jumps through a window to essentially save Julie Stiles' character, Nikki, who Desh is about to kill. And then they just sort of get into this big hand-to-hand fight. And it's unreal.
Yeah.
It's just, like, the sound effects are crazy, and it's just so intense. It's just
a very close quarters, like, almost suffocating fight. It's all cut so tightly. And yeah, very good fight, though.
Yeah.
What do you think about the guy who comes through Bourne's bedroom window on the swing with the machine gun?
Well, I mean, he's really...
That's the stealthiness, I guess.
Yeah, it's stealthy. He's really stealthy. And that's what they were. That's how they were trained in Treadstone.
I hate that part so much.
It's so goofy.
The fight that comes from it is okay, but that guy's entrance is so painful.
No, the fight that comes from it is awesome. The entrance and the exit for that guy are terrible.
Oh yeah, the exit is
he just jumps out the window and falls on the street below, where like they show a crowd of people around the body. Like, this is harder to cover up for the CIA. Like,
yeah.
Conklin will burn because of this.
Yeah, but that entrance does not seem to fit in with anything about the Bourne trilogy at all, about it being realistic, about these assassins. Nikki says they're trained to be invisible, and then here he is.
Well, he's got the spiked blonde hair. He's like the rock star assassin, maybe. He's the rebel.
Yeah, apparently he's the bad boy of the CIA assassin program, but it's Paris in the middle of the day, and he's outside, swings in on a rope, like through a giant...
Like, hey, who's that guy setting up a zip line up there? Or like a rope off the top of the building?
Through a giant plate glass window, just screaming and firing a machine gun.
I don't know that he's screaming. Is he screaming?
I think he is.
He's certainly firing a machine gun, so the screaming is a moot point, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, no, and that's the thing you get from the difference between the first movie and the second and third movie. You don't find things like that in the second and third movie. Whereas
they'll swing through the window but not scream while firing a machine.
No, like Bourne jumps.
I heard machine
window.
Gun fire. Was anyone screaming? No. Then relax, honey. Go back to bed. Everything's gonna be okay.
No, but you know what I mean.
No, like, I know.
There's significantly less laughably poor things in second and third.
I thought
as far as how they sell things.
Yeah, I thought Clive Owen would have been your favorite by far.
I just I was thinking about that, but it's just because I can't remove Clive Owen from the professor, you know? Like, it's just, I just see Clive Owen, and I just like Clive Owen, you know?
I just think he's the best one, for sure. And he gets the best lines of anybody.
Yeah, oh, he gets the best, like, that's essentially the line that sort of defines the trilogy, is, look at us, look what they make you give. And Clive Owen gets to say in the first one, and Bourne says it to, God, what was that assassin's name?
Carol? Is that his name?
No.
Or is that the guy that dies in the car?
I don't know. Carol is Matt Damon's name on 30 Rock.
No, it's like K-I-R-I-L-L.
Oh, no, that's the Russian guy in the second one. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Edgar Ramirez, his character. And, I wish I could remember his name.
What Edgar Ramirez worked for the CIA.
Yeah. And Bourne turns to him and says, look at us, look what they make you give, just before he jumps off the building, and David Strathairn as Noah Bolson shoots at him from behind.
Yeah, well, but what does that same line mean in those two different contexts, though? Because I think we're supposed to get a much different meaning from them in the two times that they say it.
I don't agree with that.
No?
Oh,
I think it's very different.
All right, well, explain.
Well, when's he use it the first time? It's
the professor is about to die.
Yeah, Clive Owen says it to Matt Damon after they have their cool little field shootout, which is a really cool shootout, too.
Mm-hmm.
And again, another very realistic gunfight of actually having to reload and things like that you don't see in a lot of action movies. And they're shooting at each other in the field, and Jason Bourne just gets the professor, and he shoots him in the chest or something.
Yep.
And so he's kind of just slowly bleeding out, and... They get close to each other and they talk, and that's one of the first times Bourne gets an indication of this used to be his job too, because the professor's saying like, oh, look at us, like, look how they train us, they make us do all this, look at what they make us give. And he kind of looks at the blood of his hands and then he dies. And I think in that context, he's saying like, look at, they're basically making us give our lives for this program. Like, we're losing our entire life. Like, we're sacrificing literally our entire lives for this program. Whereas in the third one, Matt Damon and this assassin whose name apparently we can't remember.
Edgar Ramirez.
Yeah.
Well, you're calling Bourne Matt Damon. So.
Yeah, that's true. They have sort of a little standoff there and their guns are drawn. And it looks like Edgar Ramirez clearly has the drop on Bourne.
Yeah.
Like, he's got his gun in his face. Bourne doesn't even have a weapon at this point, I don't think.
No, I don't think he does.
I think he's dropped.
Well, he shot his way out of the building.
Yeah, I think he either loses his gun or he's out of ammo or something. Okay. Or he just doesn't have his gun drawn, that's for
Fair
sure.
Enough.
So Edgar Ramirez clearly could kill him at this point. And Matt Damon says, Jason Bourne says, look at us, look what they make you give. And I think in that context, it's taking, you know, giving your own life, it's being able to take another person's life. And that, look what they make you give, they make you give up your innocence and your humanity and turn you into someone that has no problem with killing someone who they know nothing about.
Okay.
And I think that's the big difference. Do you not see it that way?
I see it as, like, I can see that. I see it as a similar thing in that Bourne doesn't have a life as a human because he gave his life away to Treadstone. And that's what he's trying to get back. He's trying to get back a life of sorts.
Oh, you know? Okay.
And so it's, and at that point, he doesn't know whether or not he's going to make that jump. That's far, you know, like, it's totally conceivable. He jumps and dies, you know, like, and he gets shot at as he jumps as well, you know? So, I mean, there are so many reasons that, you know, he could possibly be thinking, I'm about to die, you know? And yeah, I don't know. I see your point, but I think it's still very close to what the professor meant in the book.
Okay.
Identity.
So it really is just like your own personal life that you're afraid of losing.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense. I agree.
Yeah. It's a similar point that we're making.
Yeah. So you mentioned a bunch of actors there. What do you think of the cast of this trilogy?
The casting in these movies is unbelievable.
We already talked about Matt Damon being a good choice.
Yes. And then the first movie is Conklin. You've got Chris Cooper, Academy Award winner, and just all-around respected actor.
And cool dude, it seems.
Yeah. And you've also got Brian Cox as... Yeah, so Brian Cox is Ward Abbott. So we incorrectly called Albert Finney's character Ward Abbott in Bourne Ultimatum. But yeah, Brian Cox is Ward Abbott, who is just a good actor. I just like him. He's just always good and always sort of like... I don't know. He does these little actory things, like sort of like at certain points when he breathes a little harder than someone would when he's like stressed out. I like stuff like that. And you only pick those things up in movies you've seen a million times, like I have the Bourne movies. But he's very good.
What else do people really know him for and like him for?
Well, he's just sort of a character actor, you know. Like, he's one of those guys you've seen in a variety of things. He's the principal in Rushmore.
He's in Braveheart.
He's apparently in Braveheart. I have not seen Braveheart, so I can't say.
Braveheart?
Yeah, I haven't seen Braveheart.
This guy,
you
love Braveheart.
Hey,
would I? Would I love really Braveheart?
No. You don't like Awesome?
No, it's one of my least favorite things. But yeah, Brian Cox is just sort of a character actor. He's in a variety of things.
Yeah, I know him best from Deadwood, where he plays Jacqueline Grish in the fourth season. So I don't know.
Deadwood didn't get to
the third season. Yeah. Last season.
No, I didn't. I haven't seen him in it.
And he plays an actor, and he's a very kind of like theatrical, flamboyant guy. And then in this one, he's kind of just like a paper pusher, just kind of sits at a desk, like very quiet, very keeps to himself, you know? Like,
but very, very sort of like, you can tell he wields some sort of power.
Oh, no, he definitely wields power. But I mean, he's just sitting at a desk, and he's very pretty quiet. And he lives a life of secrecy, you know. He works in this agency for decades, and you get that feeling of something just below the surface where he's just very, very deliberate and restrained in pretty much everything he says and does.
Yeah, absolutely. And then starting in the second movie, you've got the delightful Joan Allen as Pam Landy, and just what a great actress in these movies. She's so good, so classy.
The character's good too, but
the character is very good, and it's sort of the only female character in the trilogy that you get that's really sort of has any sort of agency. And she ends up being like very important to the success of Bourne.
Oh yeah,
and I like that aspect a lot. I enjoy that it's not just a variety of men. Like, I'm always, or a group of men, you know, fighting against men. I always like when a female is able to, one, be a real character, which I think Landy kind of is,
yeah,
and two, basically have a big part in
absolutely.
Like in that she faxes off all the documents that Bourne steals and gives to her to basically shut down this part of the CIA. And I really like Landy's character for that, and Joan Allen's just really good in these movies.
Yeah, and it's cool that you bring that up, that, you know, that kind of is the big, one of the, half of the big success of the movie, like half of the finale, half of the closure of it is that information getting out about Treadstone and Blackfriar, right?
Yeah.
And really, I mean, there is a physical struggle throughout the entire trilogy, and certainly the chases and the battles near the end. The third one make it pretty action-packed for a conclusion, but really the kind of the climax is Bourne talking
with the guy
who turned him into who he is.
And judging from what I know about the first movie, the climax of the first movie was supposed to be his conversation with Conklin, from what I know, and then they threw in the staircase sequence because they felt they needed more action. But by the third one, they were just like, okay, we'll just throw in like an hour and 50 minutes of action straight through at the beginning, and then we'll do the conversation. And by that point, they had enough goodwill built up with Universal, and they were just like, yeah, sure, end on a conversation.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. It's all, he's got to finally go back to the beginning and learn how he became Jason Bourne.
Yeah.
And that's what the end of Bourne Ultimatum is.
Yeah, no, and I think it's just interesting that it's, I mean, as I said, there is that physical struggle, but I think the ending of so many action movies and so many spy movies and so many similar films that have these big action sequences, it's the last person dying or the last person being arrested or something like that, you know?
Or, and then you get, like, that big sweeping, like, crane shot or something showing the... Yeah,
exactly. It's a very physical, like, action-driven finale, whereas this one, the two big things that happen at the end are very information-based. Bourne figures out who he is and gets the whole...
And then we figure out that Bourne lives.
Yeah. You know? And those two things, as well as, as you said, the faxing, basically Pam Landy gets all these documents that make it very clear that this program has been pretty sketchy for a long time. These people have been abusing their power, and she just faxes it out to the media. It's just all the big reveals at the end of that movie are just information being spread out, someone dying, not, you know, the bad guy's lair imploding or anything like that. It's all just information getting out.
At the end of the Bourne movie, or Bourne Ultimatum, nobody dies.
Yeah.
There is no villain death. Like, Noah Bosum gets arrested. It's implied that Ezra Kramer, the director of the CIA, it's implied that he's at least in front of a board or something that we see. But nobody dies. Not even Albert Finney's character.
Yeah, and that's I think, another very interesting and unique thing about this as an action series. And as a big... It was a trilogy of blockbusters, essentially, but in a lot of ways like this, we see it's a lot quieter than other blockbusters, even though there's big action sequences, lots of people die, car crashes and all that. It's still very emotionally driven and very character driven and conversational, right?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah. Oh, there's certainly huge action scenes and everything like that. And these are still very expensive movies, but I think it ends on those certain notes. Even with, you said, Albert Finney's character surviving. Not just that he lives, but that is the villain of the entire trilogy, what I mean?
And it's, again, another key moment in the trilogy is when Albert Finney essentially challenges Bourne to shoot him. And Bourne's response is, no, I'm not going to do that. You don't deserve the star that they'd give you at Langley, which is essentially saying, like, it's more important that he pay for what he did than that he not have to live to pay for it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Because he's an old guy, he's going to die anyways, but might as well shame him first. You know?
Yeah, and I just think it's really cool, and it's very unique that the villain, the boss, you know, the lead bad guy is just kind of like a pasty old white dude.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's a good segue into just the politics of the Bourne movies.
It appears we love Bourne just a little bit too much for a one-part podcast, so be sure to check out part two next Thursday.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by this message from M. Night Shyamalan. I know I used to be good and now I suck. It was a conscious choice. That's the twist ending. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.wordpress.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.